Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the podcast. I'm Renee Garfinkel, your host on the New Books Network with the Van Leer Institute series on ideas. Today, we're delighted to welcome as our guest Faye Bound Alberti, who has an unusual take on the other 21st century pandemic, the emotional epidemic called loneliness. Dr. Faye Bound Alberti is a British cultural historian of gender, emotion, and medicine. She's a UK Research and Innovation Future Leaders Fellow and the co-director of the Center for Global Health Histories. Faye Bound Alberti, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Lovely to meet you.
Well, I bet that most listeners today have had at least moments and probably longer periods of time in which they felt lonely in their lives. Mm. But your thesis in A Biography of Loneliness is that loneliness was not always part of the human condition. Rather, it's a modern emotional state. Tell us why you think so.
Well, my work in the history of emotions looks at how emotions change over time and how they differ between different countries and cultures. And I became very interested in people talking about an epidemic of loneliness in the 21st century. And I, as historians of emotions tend to do, investigated where the language came from and where this anxiety around loneliness came from. And what I discovered is it wasn't really until about 1800 that the word loneliness came into being. Before then, it was used occasionally, but mostly as an equivalent to a much earlier word called wanliness. And that word meant the state of being alone, so being in solitude. And there was not the same emotional anxiety about loneliness then. And part of the reason for that is that before the modern period, people lived quite differently. This is before mass urbanization and industrialization, when there was a profound sense of God's existence and God was the explanation for things that were terrible as well as things that were good. But there was a sense of meaning. And gradually, with the emergence of modernity, that was lost. And that's the context in which the language of loneliness becomes an issue, so that you have this rise in the language of loneliness in the English language, I should add, because most of my study is about the UK and the United States, though it does make some commentary on the rest of the world. So we have this sweeping movement in a kind of post-industrial sense towards loneliness as being a secular affliction and being a modern problem. It isn't until the 1980s that it becomes talked about in terms of an epidemic or a plague or a crisis. And again, this is connected to social and economic and political factors. So the point of the book is to say loneliness is not just a single solitary emotional state or a psychological state. It's also about how we live in society.
Well, in that case, to clarify the concept, help us draw the dimensions and the boundaries of loneliness. You've already said, and I think most people would easily agree, that solitude is not loneliness.
Yes. My interpretation of loneliness is that it is an emotional lack. It's a painful sense of disconnect between the relationships you have and those that you want. Now, people can be lonely in marriages or surrounded by people. It's about the quality of that connection and that experience. And so it is very different to solitude, because people aren't always lonely when they are alone. And that has really come to the fore during the pandemic, when, you know, I think half of the world's population at points has been in lockdown. And so people are learning to be alone in different ways. We have people talking quite explicitly about feeling lonely, but other people talk about the relief of not having to go through the effort of social contact. So I do think that this pandemic is really making us think about the nuances and the complexities of loneliness. And where people are lonely, it tends to be in very different ways. So one of the arguments that I make in the book is that actually we talk about this thing called loneliness, but it's not one thing. It's a very complex cluster of emotions. If somebody is bereaved, and there is a lot of bereavement and pain at the moment in the world, that bereavement and loss means that loneliness can be mostly about grief and about mourning for somebody. Whereas if somebody spends a lot of time online, a teenage boy perhaps, it's a different quality of lack in terms of those social relationships. So loneliness is a different thing depending on what a person's circumstances are.
So when you talk about the loneliness of grief, of missing the person who's gone and feeling disconnected from other people who are still engaged in living relationships, although it's the same word, are you saying that that's a different phenomenon?
I think it is a different phenomenon. And so grief and depression and anxiety are emotions that are often associated with loneliness, but there's a profound quality of those experiences when it comes to grief, because it's a single person that you're lonely for. And no, it doesn't matter how many other people are in your life, that cannot be solved. And that's very different, say, if you're a young mother working at home, as so many people are during the pandemic, and you are juggling work and life at home, and your children are crawling over you, and you don't have a moment to yourself. You might be intensely lonely, but that will be loneliness for, you know, the time and the space that you have as a separate person to enjoy the world, because you don't have any time for yourself. So I think these nuances are important when we want to attend to the very real lived reality in people's lives, and how some people do need interventions and support, and other people can be lonely but actually okay sitting with that loneliness.
And would you say that something like homesickness or nostalgia, that they are an element of loneliness, or loneliness is an element in those phenomena? How do they fit in?
I think they are connected, Renee. And one of the reasons I think so is that so much about our sense of belonging in the world is about the material world around us. So often homesickness is about a longing for the foods or the smells or the objects that we surround ourselves with in spaces where we feel safe and we feel at home. So I think that they're entangled, and homesickness and a sense of belonging is a kind of particular form and linked to loneliness. Nostalgia is a fascinating one, because people are often a bit condemnatory about nostalgia and say that it's this, you know, sort of unrealistic longing for the good old days. But what I find fascinating about nostalgia is that in older people who are losing social connections as peer groups die and so on, nostalgia actually helps maintain a sense of belonging in the world. And partly that's because nostalgic ideas, and often it's music, and we find that in people with dementia, music or food or stories of the past make people feel connected in the present. So there is a body of work to be done on what is the function of nostalgia in preventing loneliness.
It's an interesting observation. Mm-hmm. Yes, that's true. Yeah. Although young people can also be nostalgic for a time and a place. Mm. You know, my summer in Paris.
Yes, that's right. And that's interesting, isn't it? Because the stories we tell about moments in our lives that are important to us, we're not always conscious of it at the time, but later on they become part of those building blocks by which we say, this is who I am in the world and this is what matters to me. And when one lacks those or they fall away, that's when that sense of loneliness and not belonging tends to creep in.
Even for someone who feels that they belong in their new place, nostalgia for the old place or time can coexist.
Yes, I think that's really interesting, isn't it? And maybe that's because we're never one single person or one single state of mind. We're very complex human beings, aren't we?
Yes, it seems we are. Although sometimes we seem very simple.
Yeah.
Now, you mentioned another kind of loneliness in the book, and that is loneliness that is chosen, for example, by creative people.
Yes.
And I wondered about that for a while, because if it's chosen, is it really loneliness?
I think this is a really important and interesting issue, because if we read the work of someone like Virginia Woolf, the writer, she talks a lot about loneliness in her diary, and she talks about solitude. And you're absolutely right that creative people in particular through history have chosen to be alone. And you know, in the time of kind of, the monastic desire to retreat, that was a sort of spiritual connection with God. So in a sense, hermits, in the fourth century, were not alone because they were in this mental world where God was there. And by the same token, I think people who seek solitude for the purposes of creativity, they are in conjunction with or surrounded by this sense of a higher purpose or a creative outlet. Sometimes that state of being solitudinous tips into loneliness. And there's a very interesting remark that Virginia Woolf makes in her writer's diary, where she says she's going to spend some time, even when she's with other people, seeking out loneliness in her own mind and attacking the shape of something that she wants to reach. And she talks about the pain involved in having to access that kind of loneliness, that it takes her nevertheless to the, she calls it the bottom of the vessel, to try to kind of recreate a different kind of reality. And we find this in the work of Mae Sarton too, who was a writer in the 1970s. She's talking in a journal of solitude about, although loneliness is intensely painful, it's a necessary part of the process of solitude and of creation. And what she does is she talks about how she keeps busy with nature, she gardens, and she sort of imagines her lonely mind as being tended to in the same way that you might tend to a garden, so that we go through these seasons in our mind. And it's only by nurturing and sustaining and taking care of our mental health that all of these little buds of ideas come. So these ideas around creativity and isolation and loneliness in the natural world are often sort of bundled together historically in the desire to create.
When I read that part of your book, the analogy that sprang to mind about the role of choosing a condition and is it the same as not choosing, it seemed analogous to me with people who have food scarcity. They had to have hard, it's difficult for them to get access to food compared, they experience hunger compared with someone who in the midst of abundance makes a decision for whatever reason to fast for 24 hours.
Absolutely.
They're both hungry, but they're really not at all the same.
I think that's a really wonderful analogy, not least because loneliness is often described as a kind of hunger, a sort of emotional hunger for other people. But that's absolutely right. And I do think that that's why at the heart of the book, there is a kind of political question about what is the function of the state and what is that, what are our relationship obligations in helping other people? Because there are two different kinds of loneliness in my mind, and that is loneliness that is it's existential, and it's about this feeling of not connecting for what other reason. And it can be a mark of privilege to choose to withdraw from society and spend time alone writing. And that's set against what I call structural loneliness, which is when people are utterly isolated from society and from one another, and they might have long-term health problems, mental or physical. And during this pandemic, they've not even been able to have people to come and change their bandages. I mean, that's a particularly profound material form of loneliness, which is different. And I'm not saying that existential and structural loneliness can't coexist, but that is the complexity, I think, of loneliness, that it just means different things to different people.
Maybe we should have different words for it.
Yeah, absolutely.
So would you include under existential loneliness the kind of loneliness described in ancient writings such as the Psalms, where the psalmist often expresses anguish of a deficit, an emotional deficit of feeling alone or abandoned or not in touch with God? There have been many religious writings include that.
I think this is a really important aspect of it, because talking about feeling anxious and alone in the context of a body of writing and a culture in which there is a God and there's a certainty about it, even if at that moment one feels abandoned, I think is qualitatively different to the secular loneliness that we see after the 1920s, when existential philosophers are saying God is dead and how do we make meaning in this world? I think that there is a particularly isolating sense of existential loneliness that's connected to the secular life, which isn't to say that the existential feeling of being abandoned isn't real in earlier periods or in religious spaces, but I think there are qualitative differences.
Like the difference between someone being far away and inaccessible versus someone being dead and gone.
I think that's a really good way of putting it. So I suppose in the sense that if somebody is far away and inaccessible, there's always a hope and a yearning at the same time that there is the grief and the feeling of abandonment. And we don't get that when there's a sense of disconnect because a person is dead.
Okay, so we conventionally think about loneliness as a social, emotional, psychological condition. But your writings stress another aspect, the physicality of it, the embodied nature of loneliness. Tell us about that and, if you will, about your own experience with it.
Well, you see, I'm a historian of emotion. So I've looked at how people have understood emotion since the classical period. And we have this Galenic or humoral theory of emotion that lasted for many centuries, from the second to the 18th century, really, in the West, in terms of understanding how the mind and body fitted together, how the spirit was part of that, how our relationships with others were part of that. And it's with the rise of scientific medicine, in particular in the 19th century, although you do have the separation of mind and body much earlier with Descartes, you have this scientific medicine that's compartmentalizing the body into lots of different bits and saying emotions belong in the mind and, you know, everything else can take place in the body. But it's the brain in particular in neuroscience that's become this way of thinking about emotions and our passions. And these are very individual emotions at the same time. So the mind sciences, as they emerged, took for granted that the brain was the space where emotions took place. And so I'm very interested with that long durée approach or that sort of way of thinking about emotions. I'm interested in how much of the language we use to talk about emotions is still rooted in an idea that they are bodily, that they are physical. And emotions are felt in distinct physical ways. What's interesting about loneliness is that when people go to the GP these days, they go to the doctors and say, you know, they're feeling anxious or depressed, doctors now look out for signs of loneliness, and they look out for if they are folding their arms across their chest, if they seem dejected, if they're not taking care of their personal appearance. And all of that is bundled up into how we perceive anxiety and depression being physically displayed on bodies. And that's different to how we perceive when we notice that someone is angry, they might have a flushed face or their fists might clench. So each emotion has a kind of a set of behaviour codes or emotional expressions that we expect. Because loneliness is so different, and it's not just about anxiety and depression, it manifests in lots of different ways that we are not really used to talking about. And what I noticed in studying how loneliness is physical was how often physical therapies like massage and dancing and music and moving together in collaboration with other people actually decreased feelings of loneliness. So doing things with the body, particularly with other people, reduces loneliness. Other things that I noticed were that that people talk about loneliness as heat-related. So under this humoral model that lasted for so many centuries, there's an idea that emotions are connected to heat, so that cool temperatures produce very cold and watery emotions, for instance. So you have a lot of depression linked to crying, whereas fiery people who have heat will be choleric. And there's that complex kind of language around temperature plays itself out now. So people who are lonely tend to feel cold. They describe themselves feeling cold. They take more hot baths. They have more hot drinks. They want to be surrounded by blankets and kind of swaddled. And I think those are really nice indicators of finding out whether a person is feeling lonely or is in need of some sort of social comfort. And we're a little bit back to the hunger analogies, that sort of physical hunger for warmth, which equates to the hunger for social warmth. And I think that those are very interesting. And certainly when I've had lonely experiences in my own life, and I have never I've never been a stranger to loneliness. I've had loneliness since I was a child in different ways in my life. But I am one of those people for whom it hasn't been a problem because I enjoy creativity and being alone. But I experimented when I was writing this book. And during a period of loneliness, I experimented on what difference does it make to my feelings of loneliness if I take a lot of hot baths, or I, you know, wander around with blankets on, or I move in a particular way. And it really did make a difference. And so in part, that's to do generally with when we move the body and we treat the body well. It does impact our mental health, of course. But it's also about recognizing one's physical needs as part of one's emotional health, and recognizing that tending to the body is a very profound way of tending to the mind when it comes to loneliness.
That's a very interesting way of putting elements together, because you see that warmth is so closely related to touch.
Yes.
And related to closeness, even if you're not touching, even if you have someone you're very close with whose interpersonal warmth warms you.
And
the other aspects that you talk about, like dancing and being in large groups, moving together, is being part of a whole, part of something bigger. So they're all, although not apparently the same and connected, they really are. It's an important point to bring out. Now, one out of four Americans, recent polls, even before COVID came, don't even have one confidant. That is an extraordinary survey response. How can that be? How can one fail to feel lonely in the absence of anyone to talk to?
I think that's right. And that's when I see statistics like that, of all the different competing and often contradictory statistics that we get produced around global understandings of loneliness, it's precisely that. It's that people don't have a single person to turn to strikes me as just the most profoundly painful situation. And I do think that this is linked to, it's linked to the individualism that we prioritize in the West, and this sense of there's almost a competitive individualism about how we live our lives. We focus on work, we focus on consumerism, we focus on individual successes, and we don't very often think about the wider community of which we're part or feeling accountable to others. We've seen some fairly impressive evidence of people regenerating community during the pandemic, and community is often used to describe all kinds of relationships, particularly online ones. But community at its heart, when it originated as a word, is about communitas. It's about collaboration and exchange, and you give something back. And that is what is often derided or not part of everyday life now. And I think that is what has to shift if we want to get back to a situation where people don't feel so utterly abandoned. And it's precisely that, not having anyone to sort of to see you and to recognize you. That's very much characteristic of modern culture, I think.
But historically, certain forms of distress have increased, as you note, with loneliness. Yeah. But also other forms have decreased over the centuries. Women no longer get the vapors, for example, as they did in Victorian times.
Yeah.
So talk about that a little bit.
That's very interesting. I've written before in a book called This Mortal Coil about differing attitudes towards emotions and gender over the history, over time. And there are some emotions that are very gendered, and loneliness is also very gendered. But I think it's absolutely right to say that over time, some emotions become more political and relevant and all-consuming than others. And vapors in women is a very good example. And we still see those kind of gendered ideas playing out in medicine. So it is still the case that women are far more likely when they go to the doctors to be sent home with antidepressants. And they're far more likely to be regarded as someone who's hormonal. So, you know, there are modern day variations of the vapors that still play out in those medical situations.
Well, the confluence of the physical and the social and the psychological is being borne out by other disciplines as well. Cognitive neuroscience is one where the social contagion of loneliness and other things, including addiction and obesity, has been documented, including changes, related changes in the brain.
Yeah.
Can you address that from your point of view?
Well, I'm very interested in neuroscience, particularly social neuroscience, and the work of people like the late John Cacioppo, who talk about the ways in which loneliness is contagious. And then we're back to that idea of infection, aren't we, and this image of an epidemic, but when we use words like contagion. And so this wonderful research talks about the ways in which we find changes in the brain relating to how we interact with others. I suppose from a cultural and a historical perspective, what's interesting to me is the ways in which different social practices and different ways of being through history work to inform how the brain develops. So for me, it's more of a two-way process, that our ways of being inform structural changes in the brain and vice versa. So I think that because I work on interdisciplinary material most of the time, I love to work with people in other disciplines and look at how the language of contagion, for instance, can work both as a way of understanding changes in the cell structure of the brain, but also how we communicate with others and how loneliness might spread. You know, in social terms, if we see people who are lonely, there is a tendency to avoid them. And it happens, particularly in Britain, it happens where people feel there's a kind of element of shame attached to loneliness. So that people, if they see someone as being lonely, we have a phrase which is Billy No Mates, which means that nobody actually cares enough to be friends with this person, and there's clearly something wrong. And one of the interesting changes with the pandemic is because we have now a language of loneliness in which it's not only people who were perceived as oddballs who are feeling lonely, but actually, hang on, a lot of people are feeling lonely. And the ways in which loneliness is talked about is changing. It opens up the capacity for a sort of contagion of kindness or a contagion of community. So there are different ways in which we can use the language of contagion to talk about social change that are really positive rather than seeing it as entirely negative.
And so you think that now people are not ashamed to say that they feel lonely?
There's definitely less shame, I think. And I do think it's because people who ordinarily are seen as much more outgoing and sociable and gregarious are the ones who are stepping up on social media and saying they're lonely in lockdown. And that's been quite an interesting shift. So it changes the idea that if you are lonely, then it's because you don't know how to communicate, because it allows the possibility that loneliness is something that can affect anyone if the circumstances aren't right. What will be interesting is whether or not that shifts back after the lockdown, whether there is now an acceptance that people can be lonely, or whether that will switch back again. I guess it depends what happens with the pandemic.
Well, you're right that in the COVID times, it's clearly situational to say, I miss the life I had and I feel lonely without it. A few decades ago, the famous psychoanalyst Frieda Fromm Reichmann wrote a groundbreaking, and I have to say a heartbreaking, essay on loneliness.
Yes.
She noted in that writing that loneliness is so excruciating that most people don't talk about it. They don't even want to be reminded of it. And this was mid-century, yes. 1950s and 60s.
Yes.
She, in other writings, she noted that the essential work of her analysis with people that helped so many severely ill, mentally ill patients get better was her ability to be present with the pain of their loneliness.
Yeah.
Do you think that's still the case?
Yes, I think that is the case in terms of, I think she was absolutely right about the pain. There's a physical and a psychic pain that accompanies profound and extreme loneliness, particularly when it's attached to time, so that over a longer period of time, when the loneliness is chronic and there's a sense of it being unending and actually quite desperate, that is a profundity of experience that becomes very hard to communicate to somebody else. And it's been shown that the lonelier people get, the more they are likely to be within themselves, and the harder they find it even to register or understand a person's emotional expressions, so that they might read a particular emotional expression as rejection when it's not intended that way. And I think, you know, the fact that we are supposed to be very social beings, even when we are introverted, we are still essentially, humans are still a social species. I think there is a profoundness of experience there that unless we are able to communicate it, we do become very trapped and very locked in. And that's what I meant really by talking about the experience of COVID is allowing it, these languages to be more nuanced and people to say, this is happening and I'm feeling this, and to think about and reflect on what function loneliness is having in their own lives.
Yes. And as you point out, people who are lonely because of COVID isolation are experiencing transient loneliness as compared with the chronic loneliness you just mentioned, which is so terribly destructive.
Yes.
And may even be physically destructive, so that it changes the brain, as you said, to perceive the world differently. Yeah. But you also bring in another very interesting and maybe a little more lighthearted topic, which is romance.
Yes.
you say that the notion of the soulmate and the romantic ideal of finding the one contributes to loneliness.
Well, this comes really from thinking about what individualism means. So we have this very paradoxical situation, particularly in Western culture, where we're encouraged to find the one, but at the same time, that one is supposed to be waiting for us. And it comes from these Platonic ideals about, you know, there's another part of ourselves waiting out there in the world for us. But at the same time, even romance is structured in very competitive ways, and women are encouraged to be competitive to one another, and the pursuit is always all important to, you know, to find the man to settle down. It tends to be very heterosexual, and it tends to be focused on this kind of very patriarchal family. And I think that the challenge is some of these narratives about finding our special one, soulmate, and so on, contribute to the sense of loneliness, because a lot of people, even those who, you know, been in long relationships and are married, they still don't feel that sense of connect. And so the reason I talked about that was really just to highlight that the sense of alienation that can happen when there is a gap between the relationships that you have and those that you feel you ought to have. So that idealizing this sense of the, you know, the love that never lets you down, which in a sense is akin to the love of a parent or the love of a god, that actually can be quite self-destructive if that is the pursuit on its own. And when we see this growth of loneliness, particularly among middle-aged people who are divorced, and that corresponds to this search for love online, which can be a very fruitless endeavor, I think we need to ask questions about what expectations we're putting on love and the idea that we will be completed by another person, which I do see as part of that entanglement of individualism.
And would that explain why millennials are the most likely generation cohort to report feeling lonely?
I think millennials do actually feel lonely a lot, don't they? But I also wonder whether in talking about loneliness as being inevitable or being entirely negative or being part of life for millennials, I wonder whether we also sort of produce a self-fulfilling prophecy, because it becomes a way of talking about experiences to feel, you know, we might be feeling one of those pinch points of experience where we're inevitably going to feel lonely when our life is changing or we're moving in a new direction. But then, you know, it becomes loneliness, and it becomes an identity to feel lonely and disconnected. So while I'm sure that there are high rates of loneliness among millennials as other groups, I do also think that we can produce it because of the ways that we talk. And we do actually blame millennials for quite a lot as well. And I wonder if that sort of that distancing and that attitude sometimes, I think, can be quite problematic.
And people often blame the loneliness of the young on social media use.
Yeah, they do. And I'm intrigued by that, because I think it's simplistic to talk about social media as being entirely bad. People have panicked about every form of technological innovation that's come along, and they worried that the landline, for instance, the telephone, would stop. Well, they worried that it would make women talk too much, and that it would, you know, instead of doing their chores, and that it would mean that people couldn't do face-to-face conversations anymore because they were too busy on the phone, and they would lose the skills. And of course, this is really familiar ground. We're used to these sorts of ideas. With social media, it can be positive, it can be negative, and what would we do without it right now is what strikes me. There is evidence that people who are lonely and have social anxiety, they benefit from being able to use social media. I think there is also a space for social media in many people's lives. The challenge is when it replaces all forms of social contact. So the evidence suggests that when people have relationships in real life and these are continued online, or people have a blend of relationships offline and online, you know, social media can actually reduce loneliness. Where it's problematic is when it's the only kind of contact there is. And that's one of the interesting things to me about what's happening during this pandemic, is that we get to have these wonderful conversations online, but that we lack the sort of sensory experiences that go along with them. And so we've talked about touch. And of course, if you might, you know, you'd meet friends for a cup of coffee, and there might be hugs, and there'd be also a wide range of sensory clues going on to how people are feeling and how the conversation is going. And on Zoom or on online conversations or on social media, these are very narrowed. So I think there's a quality missing, which is why people who have no offline friendships don't feel it's enough. And there is another question also, which bleeds us back to the sense of community. And if community is about connectedness and responsibility and accountability to each other, online communities don't tend to have that. Online communities are about particular interests. So whether it's Kim Kardashian or, you know, vegetables, I mean, these are interest groups, but there's no sense of loyalty or compassion or accountability for people from one another. And which is very different then to offline community and how that is embedded into the physical structure of everyday life.
Well, speaking of community, the 21st century has, besides the growth of loneliness, mm-hmm. has also seen the growth of marginal groups like mm-hmm. the homeless and large refugee populations. Mm-hmm. What is the significance of having a home in the experience of loneliness and in the notion of the role of community?
Mm. Some of the loneliest people of all are homeless people, and I think this idea of the roofless and the rootless and the homeless and refugees, they tend to be the most marginalised in society and the ones that people don't really think about in relation to loneliness. And some of the issues around belonging to home, of course, it's not just a shelter. It's all of the emotional attachments and the sense of being worth something and the sense of belonging, those complex emotional things that make us feel part of the world, that's what's missing. So for homeless people, for instance, loneliness is another burden on top of often problems with addiction, histories of abuse, can have mental illness. There's a whole cluster of problems. And I think loneliness needs to be tended to too, because it can produce a lot of difficulties, both physical and psychological. And the same is true of the refugee status. And as you say, it's becoming, both of these experiences are becoming worse and more common statistically. And tending to the physical needs of refugees and the emotional needs of refugees is often far down the scale of what is considered important by governments. And one of the things I noticed, for instance, is that elderly refugees are often not given things like hearing aids, which are so basic to make somebody feel that they belong to a community and they can hear other people talking. It's these things that are considered almost luxuries, but they're fundamental to a sense of belonging. And of course, the problem with refugees and with homelessness is the way in which they are socially ostracized and they are alienated. And I can't imagine any form of loneliness more profound than being looked at on the street as though you shouldn't be there, that you don't belong, even with which small amount of space you're taking up. And so I think an all-inclusive approach to loneliness as being structural and existential has to take account of what it means to belong in a fundamental way to a country, to a house, to a home, to a group of people, to feel included.
Absolutely. In fact, it often occurred to me that what was most painful, what might have been most painful to someone living on the street, is that everyone who walks by looks away.
Yeah. It's not
they
to
don't even
be,
look yeah. them in, yeah, they don't look them in the eye to say, I see you, yeah. I like you.
Yeah. It's very dehumanizing, isn't it? That's precisely, I think, what I've observed.
It's the extreme of objectifying that we look at objects.
Yeah, that's right.
But I'd like to get back. You mentioned the role of neoliberalism in encouraging loneliness. I'd like you to expand on that a little, because we've reviewed so many aspects of loneliness and physical and psychological and historical. Now let's drill down a little bit on the political.
Yeah, so when we see the emergence of loneliness first becoming very common, around about 1800, that is accompanied by social and political and economic changes. Which mean that this drive towards individualism and away from a sense of collective responsibility is what facilitates the Industrial Revolution. It's what allows factories to start producing. It allows piece rate. It allows the idea of somebody, being paid for their labour. But it also allows this kind of movement that we have never seen before. And some of this is positive, of course. I'm in no way saying that early modern cultures were wonderful places to be, but it changes the ways in which people interrelate, and it changes how people feel accountable or not for other people. So the waves of industrialization, urbanization, and secularity and change that accompanied the growth of post-industrial nations impacted on a person's sense of belonging and impacted on one's relationship with others, so that competitive individualism tends to be what matters. And the neoliberalism that is about the responsibility being on individuals, not being on the state, has produced severe problems, I think, not just in existential ways, but in structural ways. So one of the issues that we have in the UK is that we are, as far as I know, the only country in the world to have decided we need a Minister for Loneliness. And we put that into place in 2018. Now, in many ways, this has functioned as a soundbite. It's a way of saying we recognise it's a problem or an epidemic, but it's not related to social or political or economic systems. But the reality is that at the same time as developing a Minister for Loneliness, there has been a complete breakdown in health and social care. There are more homeless people. There are even libraries, this space where people could come together without having to buy anything. Even libraries are being closed down. So it is a sense that the neoliberal policies that enable both individualism and social exclusion are producing loneliness. And I think One of the interesting things of thinking about loneliness in a global sense is that even those collective cultures like Vietnam that traditionally did not report these levels of loneliness are finding that where we have globalization and more consumer goods and more money available, particularly for the rising middle classes and the relatively young people, we have higher rates of consumerism, but that is also accompanied by profound levels of loneliness. And there is some interesting evidence that shows that lonely people are more likely to buy things. So there is an argument, actually, mm-hmm. that loneliness is useful. Loneliness prevents people from allying against governments. It encourages people to spend. So there is an argument where we could see loneliness as being useful to neoliberalism. But that cycle of dependency that gets created with materialism and loneliness is something that I think we really need to think about. Because if lonelier people buy more, the problem is that once they have bought, they still have loneliness. So loneliness is no replacement for social relationships or feeling cared for. And what happens is they then buy more. And this all perpetuates this disposable consumer economy, which isn't great for the planet and it's not great for us.
No, but it's not uncommon for people to default to retail therapy.
No, absolutely.
For any distress. That's right.
Yeah.
What would you like to see the Minister of Loneliness mm-hmm. do? What actual steps could government take?
Well, I think that understanding the complexities of loneliness. So I'd like to see the language change on how we talk about loneliness. I'd like it to be understood as a much more complex cluster of different emotions. I'd like for there to be a recognition that sometimes it's existential and sometimes it's structural. And when it is structural, what changes in welfare and social care can we put into place that prevent this from happening? How do we create communities that make people feel included and like they have a desire to belong? I mean, this is one of the problems in the UK with Brexit is that it has just revealed these huge differences in how people identify with the country and how they identify with each other. And I think that it is the job of government to start healing some of those divisions in order to produce a better sense of well-being in society. And I'd also like for medical healthcare to focus on thinking about ways in which mind and bodies relate and how dealing with the body and tending to the body as a way of dealing with mental health is also important. And it's a way of moving beyond this language of loneliness as an epidemic that is something that, is entirely about us as individuals, whereas it's actually something about how we relate as individuals to each other and the society of which we're part. So most of this is about changes in language, but it's also about responsibility and accountability. And I'm not sure how we'd ever get there or whether we're going to get there, but it remains a goal.
And you think government can play an important role rather than the traditional forms of combating or preventing loneliness or mm-hmm. creating belonging, which are family, religion, ethnicity, mm-hmm. neighborhood, something on a more local level than government?
I think it's a two-way process. I mean, I think we all have responsibility to other people and accountability to other people. I think that government can play a role in leading by example. I mean, I think if you look at how New Zealand have handled the COVID crisis and the sense of inclusivity and support that's been given to everybody, that's a really key indication of that. And sometimes the language of politics can divide people. I think that politicians have a responsibility to think about not just whether they're funding the right areas, but also whether they are, modelling good citizenship. What is it to be a good citizen? And certainly that runs parallel for me with being accountable for others and, you know, trying to do good in the world in order to prevent other people from feeling loneliness. And actually, when we do things for other people, it makes us feel less lonely. So it's not just altruistic.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Right. Well, Faye, it's been a very enjoyable conversation and you've been very generous with your time. Before I let you go, tell us about what you're working on now.
Yeah, well, the UKRI-funded fellowship that I'm doing, the Future Leaders Fellowship, is allowing me to look at the history of face transplants. So this is taking my work on emotions and bodies and the sense of belonging and looking at how this works when people have had facial difference, when they've had accidents, when facial transplantation has become an option. And what does that do to our sense of identity and belonging? So the project is looking at questions around the history of face transplants internationally from 2005 to the present. And it connects with this work because also often people feel lonely because they are socially ostracized. And we don't really talk about that so much, but people with facial difference or people who are the object of scrutiny because of how they look, they do feel profoundly lonely.
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Very important work because even slight disfiguration or anomalies have a profound emotional impact, especially on growing children and adolescents.
Absolutely. But thank you so much for your time. It's been a real pleasure to talk to you.
And thank you for your important work and for being on the show today. And thanks to our researcher, Bela Pasikoff. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thank you.